I'd like to welcome everyone to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and I'm joined here by Daniel Houck and Joel Chopp, both Dr. Daniel and Dr. Joel, I should properly announce them as. And we're a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And thinking seriously, we've endeavored to create an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, cheerful confessionalism. And in this episode, this is going to be fun. We're going to do this at least once a quarter. Just a couple of friends, as well as Joshua Lee Harris, who's not able to get his mic to work today, but he'll usually be joining us. And just talking about matters of theology among friends of different traditions, and it'll be fun. So we have a large center of shared presuppositions and shared sort of dispositions when it comes to the task of theology and what it looks like. And we differ sort of, I think, more on ecclesiological matters and some other areas, but nothing that is like of major significance. And so that, to me, allows a lot of interesting and fruitful discussion about matters of theology. When you know, here's the center that I agree on, here's the areas that are up for debate and that we disagree on, and it can be a lot of fun. So today, I'll be talking about a symposium that, Joel, you're the managing editor. Is that your title at Pro Ecclesia?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so he's the managing editor at Pro Ecclesia, a wonderful journal, and they did a symposium on the colloquy of Regensburg, and I probably butchered both of those words. And yet, here we are. So maybe, Joel, I mean, this is on original sin and stuff. I didn't even know this existed. I think it's fascinating. I'd love if you could give me just like a brief overview of what historically where this is located and then how the symposium came about.
So the Regensburg Colloquy occurred in 1541. So this is upstream of the Council of Trent. And it was a meeting of both Protestant and Catholic, Roman Catholic theologians to try and hammer out some statements on the theological issues that divided them. So relatively recently, Anthony Lane has been doing a lot of really great work on the articles on justification that came out of the colloquy. So there's an OUP book that Lane put out. I don't know how many years ago. It hasn't been all that long ago on Regensburg on justification. And this symposium includes the first ever English translation of the articles on original sin that Matt Gaetano at Hillsdale College translated for us, and deals with original sin, free choice. And one of the things that I just love about this symposium and Gaetano's work and the other contributors is, so in Gaetano includes some pretty extensive backstory in the notes of the translation about the different articles and the arguments and debates between the Protestants and Catholics on the different articles. And it's fascinating because you can see that the divisions aren't neat and tidy. So you had Cardinal Contarini, who was Protestant sympathetic. Often you see him defending Bucer and some of the Protestants' concerns, whereas Eck is kind of going hard, and he has against the Protestants, and there's a couple great lines about such and such a phrase is melanchthonic, and he means that as not a compliment, because that's kind of the two hardliners, Eck and Melanchthon, and then some of the those who are closer together. So that's the colloquy, that's what it's about, and the symposium, so it has the translation of the articles. There's an introduction by Matt Gaetano that kind of situates the colloquy historically. And then one of the things I love about it, and I had nothing to do with setting this up. This was Mickey Maddox and some work by some of the folks contributing. So Mike Root has a Catholic response. And Root was actually one of the framers of the Joint Declaration on Justification. Rick Serena has a Lutheran response. Serena's a Lutheran theologian, Missouri Synod. And so there are those two responses as well. So that's the symposium. You should check it out, Pro Ecclesia, latest edition.
Joel, before we move on, I mean, how is it that I didn't even know this existed? Because is it just truly I should know, and I should know better, and I need to be told that you need to do your homework? Or is this actually pretty like buried for some reason?
Yeah, I mean, so it's one of, and to be fair, I was familiar with Tony Lane's work on Justification. This wasn't really on my radar either until kind of this symposium. And I think, well, for one obvious reason is it was a failed consensus document. It broke down. And as a failed consensus document, there's those who would later sign the Formula of Concord. And on the one hand, and those who view Trent as authoritative, they're not going to, what's the point of this earlier failed consensus document? So kind of from like a material standpoint, that might be one reason why it's not on a lot of folks' radar. But also it's fascinating to me that like, wow, this seems like a pretty important document and it's just buried, at least in terms of my own kind of, not as a non-Reformation scholar. Yeah. So,
I mean, there's a lot of, so like going through just the translation piece, like to me, there's a lot of interesting comments in here as well as the additional essays on it. I don't know if anyone sort of wants to take anything as sort of a launching pad to say, let's discuss this. But I'm sure, Danny, I'm sure you've got stuff that comes to mind that you'd want to discuss.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe we could start with the definition of original sin in the document. It's very difficult. I was sympathetic with some of the criticisms that Eck raised to this document. But my understanding is that, and I haven't read Eck firsthand on this, so I'm relying on the symposium summary here, but he raised an objection that this document, perhaps unintentionally, took position on matters that were disputed among theologians, which if you want to generate a widespread agreement, you're not going to want to do that unintentionally. So I don't know how intentional it was or not, but I do think that there's something to what he was saying. So maybe we could talk about this a little bit. So Article 4 on original sin, let's start there. I actually want to start just by flagging a possible inconsistency in the document with regard to the definition. We could also just talk about the whole question of defining original sin and what that even means. But Article 4, that it begins by saying, therefore, we say that original sin is the lack or defect of original righteousness that ought to be in us. Now, then, so as far as a possible inconsistency, then a little bit later on in this article, this is going to be the third paragraph of the article. It says, and so for the character or ratio of original sin, we require simultaneously and in combination both the defect of original righteousness that ought to be in us, as well as concupiscence or the vicious habit. So right off the bat, I'm seeing a little bit of an inconsistency here, because those are two different ways of defining original sin. And there's actually a lot of debate in the Middle Ages over how to define it. There's other definitions as well. But one way you can define original sin, and this is a more Anselmian approach, is you can say it's the lack of original justice that ought to be present, and focus on the will. That was Anselm's approach. Or you can define original sin as concupiscence, or you could combine the two. And defining it as concupiscence was something that Peter Lombard did, indebted to Augustine. Thomas Aquinas combined those definitions. So his definition includes the lack of original justice, but he spells it out as such as to include disorder, concupiscence as the material cause, and the disorder in the will as the formal cause. So the point is that there was a lot of debate in the Middle Ages over how to define it. And then I'm seeing a little bit of slippage in the Article 4. On the one hand, it's defined as the lack of original righteousness that ought to be present, the lack of due original righteousness, in other words. And then they add in concupiscence. And moreover, then they start defining concupiscence in a very particular way, which is itself also the subject of debate. Like, what is the nature of disordered concupiscence?
Yeah. So in the symposium, Root picks up some of these lines, Danny, and he notes, so what you're seeing in the translation, Mike Root kind of notes that it starts out to just, it looks like they're going straight Anselmian, right? With that initial, you know, original sin is the lack or defect of original righteousness that ought to be in us. But then here they add concupiscence. right? And so that's deliberate. Right. So broadly speaking, the Catholics tilt Anselmian, the Protestants are more concerned with concupiscence. And so, yeah, here's Mike Root. The Article 4 appears to take a firm position on the question, siding with the Anselmian approach. As the text proceeds, however, that appearance is corrected, as Gaetano notes. I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name. Grouper's text adds to the opening sentence of the article, the phrase "with concupiscence." And so the article seemed to be following the well-trodden medieval path of combining the two strands in a hybrid definition, like Aquinas and Scotus.
And so you think, Joel, it was intentional that they equivocated?
No, so I don't think they're equivocating. I think that they are merely like the first line in Article 4 is not the full definition. Definition is the "and so" in the third paragraph. And so for the ratio of original sin, we require simultaneously and in combination both the defect of original righteousness that ought to be in us, as well as concupiscence or the vicious habit. That, I think, is they're going with that. Now, having said that, in terms of internal consistency, one of the other things that Root raises is where the framers say that the formal element of original sin is guilt rather than defect of original justice. So that's that, which is what one would expect.
So I haven't read this, I haven't read all of Root, but he mentions in here about how the derangement of human powers, for example, concupiscence, is an effect of original sin, but not the essence of original sin. It is not what original sin is. So I haven't read his whole essay, so I don't know if he's explaining here, basically saying that first definition seems to be more appropriate, whereas even though they're adding in concupiscence in the second piece, that's not actually the formal definition. Am I thinking about that right?
So yeah, there are worries in the neighborhood because so I was excited to talk about this. This raises, even as a failed consensus document, it raises really interesting questions about the use of scholastic terminology in theology and how loosely or tightly one needs to take confessional documents, right? And so the Lutherans were inclined to use, when they used the material formal distinction in their kind of theological work, they were very okay with using it very loosely, whereas by and large, the Catholics were not. And so that's one issue that gets raised. But I want to kind of return back to Danny's point about Eck, and because one of Eck's criticisms was, look, this document is nailing down things that are debated in the schools. And so specifically on this particular issue, wants to agree with Alexander of Hales over and against Aquinas and Bonaventure, or maybe it's Aquinas and Scotus, I forget. And so his argument is, look, we shouldn't have confessional documents that are ruling out live debates in the schools. That shouldn't be what we're doing. So real quick, what do you guys think about that? Just in terms of extrapolate from Regensburg, in terms of confessional documents or even consensus documents.
I mean, this whole thing, there's so many interesting aspects of this. So you're mentioning here, the debates in the schools. I don't know when historically it sort of seems to shift where the center of the debates are no longer in the schools, but seem to be in sort of confessional institutions or churches of some sort. That's my armchairing. It seems like that happens post-Reformation, where it decentralizes all that sort of locus of debate. And so then that makes the question even more confusing and difficult. I've been reading Ian Christopher Levy's the Pure Conscience volume that I don't know if it's out yet. I mean, I have a book copy of it, so obviously it's available somehow. But it's been super fascinating, and reading about some of the debates and how the sort of university structure is structured and everything, and sort of the nature of debates and the nature of sort of tolerance for disagreements. Super, super interesting. So I don't really have a good answer to any of these questions other than I'm looking forward to hearing what you guys say.
Yeah, and I would say too that with original sin in particular, it's really tricky because there's always been a huge, I mean, since the throughout the Middle Ages, there was a huge amount of debate on how to define, how to understand it. And so when you have all these debates about the basic essence of original sin, how do you come to an agreement that kind of abstracts and finds like the nature of the doctrine? You don't have original sin you don't have like a kind of Nicene Creed that gives you the basic kind of definition. So it's very tricky. I mean, so let's say you have this debate, like some people say original sin's the lack of justice in the will. Some people say it's concupiscence or these disordered desires. Some people say it's simply imputed by God as Adam's sin that's imputed. So it's this kind of debt of punishment. How do you like, those are different theories, arguably, of the doctrine. How do you come up with a definition of the doctrine that abstracts from those? You know, I don't think that the attempt at compromise even really tries to do that. But I think if they were gonna succeed, they would have needed to at least attempt abstracting from the debates. I try to, in my book on original sin, I give a shot at this. But it's very abstract. I try to define the doctrine of original sin as basically that the human being's embodied individual existence normally begins with sin. I'm like, and I'm just trying to intentionally abstract from the different theories, but that doesn't really tell you very much. So yeah, it's just tough. But the way that they go very specific, and especially if you're right, Joel, and I think maybe you are, that the attempted formal definition is when they get to the ratio. Although if you're right, it's still a little odd to define it differently in the first sentence of the article, because I think that's just a confusing way to frame it. But if you're right that they're trying to more specifically define it in the middle there, they then immediately define concupiscence in a way that's also like very specific. They say that, basically, when concupiscence is combined with this lack of original righteousness, it's not able not to spring up into every kind of actual sin in those who are not born again, which is a very specific account of disordered concupiscence. So Aquinas, for example, would disagree with that characterization of disordered concupiscence. And so, I don't know, it does make me kind of wonder with Eck whether, I mean, I'm not going to be as strong as he was about calling these guys like amateur theologians and stuff, but it does kind of make me wonder how much they really knew about the original sin. And then they're trying to come up with this big agreement, but do they really know what they're talking about?
Yeah. So in defense of the Protestants, so one of the, and really I'm just going to continue Gaetano's note here. So, you know, Eck raises the charge that the other framers of Regensburg assert what's open to debate among the theologians, right? And so Eck is saying, like, look, the theologians debate this. We shouldn't be nailing anything down. But then, actually, interestingly, one of the Catholic participants responds and says that Eck's concerns are vain and made without just cause. So this is Fluke. Fluke says Eck's concession that Aquinas and other scholastics accept faith in Adam was significant. And then if the Regensburg book could not say anything that was debated in the schools, there would not be left many certain things for us that we could assert, which seems fair, right? So like in the schools, consider what else is debated, right? And thinking again also about Regensburg, just like really, really key doctrines related to like the fundamental issues in the Reformation. Like justification, that's debated in the schools. So that a doctrine is debated in the schools, I don't think should prescind theologians attempting to arrive at a consensus document on it. Because yeah. Otherwise we wouldn't be able to assert anything. Yeah, Danny. Well,
I would agree with that. And I wasn't necessarily trying to pick on the Protestants, although help me understand the nature of this document. Was this not the agreement of all six of the theologians, Protestant and Catholic?
Well, yeah. So what we're getting in the notes is Gaetano's kind of pulling back the scenes and the curtain and showing us the arguments about the different articles after they're drafted, right? And so you come up with a draft and then people weigh in pro and con on various issues.
So maybe this is a stupid question, but like, I feel like in modern theology, I don't see people talking about concupiscence or that terminology at all. And it seems like it's super important to have a good grasp of that. I think back to my MDiv, I don't think I ever heard that word one time.
Yep. And it's, it is in a lot of ways fairly central to a range of like important fundamental doctrinal issues at the heart of the Protestant Reformation. And one of the reasons I'm excited about this symposium is it's showing that. But you're right, Jordan. Interestingly, the doctrine of concupiscence, if it gets talked about at all, kind of within evangelical Protestantism, it gets raised in the context of debates about persons who are same-sex attracted and quote unquote gay Christian debates. And so the PCA had, was it a study document? Might have been a study document that addressed some of these issues. And that's, for a lot of folks, the issue of same-sex attraction put concupiscence kind of back in the theological vocabulary. But all that to say, kind of the broader context of the doctrine, for a lot of reasons, it is not a normal kind of run-of-the-mill, everyday concept that we hear employed in evangelical theology or even preaching.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first time I heard it, I was at a conference on virtue-related material, and it was like a Roman Catholic using it. So my brain, I'm like, oh, Catholics talk about concupiscence. That's not a category that we Protestants have.
So like roughly for our listeners, it's debated in many ways, but like roughly you can think about disordered concupiscence as our disordered desires, and more specifically, the habitual condition that we're in of not having rightly ordered desires. So like, for example, I can be on a diet. I can see the cheesecake. I get hungry for the cheesecake before I consciously choose to want that hunger. And we could use all kinds of examples with, you know, lust. We could talk about many different things. We feel ourselves desiring things in such a way that if we were to consent and follow them, it would be bad for us. And the traditional view of the state of creation that Adam and Eve were made in was that they were made in such a way that they had no disordered concupiscence. So they would have naturally desired good things. And this is why famously St. Augustine says that the original sin, the originating original sin of Adam and Eve, both actually in terms of the act that they committed, must have been pride in the will, because their sensuality, their desires were made right by God. So they would have had to have consciously chosen to go astray. It's not like they could blame a bad appetite or lust that was kind of just springing up through no fault of their own. And so then, to make a long story short, a lot of people have debated, like we mentioned earlier, whether when we're born, everyone agrees that we are born with these bad desires, habitually speaking. Like, there's no human beings that just kind of grow up and all their desires are perfect. That doesn't happen. And so people debate, is it a sin to have that kind of habit of disordered concupiscence? Or does sin only come in later when you, for example, consent to a disordered desire? And oh, by the way, everybody, Protestant and Catholic, also agrees that morality is not fundamentally about external behavior. The debate is going to be whether in your will you have to consent in order for sin to come into the picture. So it's not nobody's saying like it's only bad if you like externally do bad actions. Hopefully that helps a little bit with the context here. And I'll stop for a second if you guys want to jump in, but.
Yeah, it's super helpful, Danny. Thanks for that. Super helpful.
But I'll throw out something. Let's have a little discussion here. My view, I'm an evangelical Protestant, but I want you guys to push back on me if you want to. But I personally don't see why Protestants couldn't agree with the traditional Anselmian view that was the mainstream Catholic view in the Reformation, to the effect that concupiscence is not in and of itself sinful, but that sin comes into the picture, actual sin comes into the picture through consent. To me, there's a lot of good reasons for this, and I don't see why it would cause me to lose any kind of Protestant, you know, essential Protestant doctrine. So, and let me just throw out one reason for this, that there's a few reasons, but one reason that Anselm gives is that we see non-human animals have concupiscence and yet they're not guilty of sin. And so there's one argument. Another argument that I would make is that it's important to distinguish, biblically speaking, between temptation and sin. And if concupiscence is itself sinful, even it's habitual, then it becomes impossible to make a meaningful distinction between the temptation internally to sin and the act of sin when we consent to sin. And I would even make a Christological point here. I think we see, scripturally speaking, that Jesus Christ, although perfect and a fulfiller of the law in every way, totally without sin, biblically speaking, he is presented as being tempted in every way that we are tempted. And so it's unclear to me how that's possible if concupiscence itself or the kind of internal temptation to sin is already sinful. I'm just throwing it out there, but you guys push back. Tell me why I'm a bad Protestant.
You probably are, but maybe not for this reason. Well, so any thoughts, Joel? I've got a couple thoughts, but
yeah, you go, Joel. You're much more.
Yeah. So and just for our listeners, et cetera, I hope you go and read the symposium. But one of the issues that's really the tension points is Protestants want to say that concupiscence is sin per se. Like it's sin. Whereas by and large, Catholics don't want to draw that line.
I want to pause here just a second. Like, tell me, Joel, like, I want to learn more about that. Do you have any good resources that are defending concupiscence as sin?
Yeah. So it's been a while since I've read it, but so this is Concordia Press is doing the world a favor in producing the Theological Commonplaces of Johann Gerhard. They're really, really beautiful books. Very, very well done. Translated, freshly translated. He's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, kind of Lutheran scholastic theologian, yeoman's work. Anyways, so here's the volume on sin and free choice that really kind of gets. So if you want to do, like, if you want to jump into these issues even more than the Proecclesia Symposium from a Protestant perspective, this would be one of the go-to volumes. Highly recommend. So the, that's kind of different emphases. And one of the chief concerns is the Catholics are worried that if we define concupiscence as kind of like sin per se, then we lose the distinction between original sin and actual sin, right? Which that's an important distinction that does really important work with how we think about doctrine of sanctification, how we think about doctrine of baptism. Now, I love our spread here today because we've got the Reformed Baptist, we've got the Arminian Baptist, and then we've got the Wesleyan Arminian. So there's kind of good diversity, but it's got implications for all of these doctrines. So,
could I jump in, Joel? Or were you making a final point? I was going to say, I mean, some of these differences come out in this document. So, one of the implications of taking a Anselmian, I'll say Anselmian rather than Catholic, because I actually don't, like I said, I don't think this is essentially a Catholic view. And I think later on, there are Protestants who these things get more, the battle lines that are drawn in the 16th century get redrawn later and everything. So I'll just call it the Anselmian view. One of the implications of taking the Anselmian view that a lot of Protestants had a problem with is that once you are born again, it would appear that you could fulfill the law at that point. Now, obviously, no one's claiming you're like perfectly fulfilling the law. I mean, everybody's acknowledging original sin and everybody's acknowledging on a practical level, there's various actual sins committed before, by adults and things like this. But I mean, in theory, if concupiscence is not in and of itself sinful, and then you're born again, you're given grace, you're justified, it would appear that you could then follow the law. And
yeah, no, so, and that's why I appreciate this question, Danny, because, so in our symposium, we have, Matt Gaetano doing the translation and the introduction, the historical work, and then a Catholic and a Lutheran respondent. I'm really, really curious about, like, it would have been interesting to get a broader range of Protestant perspectives, because reading the symposium as a Wesleyan in particular, like, we're going to make different theological judgments than our Lutheran brothers and sisters. Because, like, as the symposium gets into this, there's also the issue of the Imago Dei and the loss of the Imago Dei. What does that mean? Well, the document itself is pretty clear that it's a loss of an aspect of the Imago, not the Imago totally. But the document's also pretty clear about the possible restoration of the Imago Dei as full restoration as only being possible in glory in the beatific vision. Wesleyans are going to have different things to say about those issues, and yet also we're Protestant. So all that to say.
And I mean, Joel, tell me if some of these other articles cover it, but the question of guilt and imputation seem also super relevant to the conversation, where I think can you make a consensus statement on some of these things? Maybe that's just impossible by the nature of the positions you have to take on some of them. And so if you want to have consensus, you have to basically just ignore some of the downstream questions to say anything that is a consensus. Otherwise, you are then making the dividing lines of the various confessional institutionalized documents that come later.
And no, great point, Jordan. I think that's right. And it's not impossible that Protestants and Catholics could get back together and try and make more consensus documents today. Right. And it's not positive, not only not just possible, because it's actual, it's happened. Right. So with the joint declaration. Danny, do you have any thoughts before I?
Well, I think it's fun to, we're talking a lot of method today because that's very much on the topic of this colloquy, but let's push a little bit more into the theology. So I'm curious. I mentioned, one of the problematic implications for a lot of the early Protestants of the Anselmian view is that you can fulfill the law after you're born again. But, why is that such a huge problem? I mean, Romans 8:5, those who live according to the flesh have their minds set on what the flesh desires. Those who live in the spirit have their minds on what the spirit desires. I mean, why is it, is that such a bad thing to say that once we're born again, that we can fulfill the law with the point being that we've been forgiven? And so there's not a law fulfillment simpliciter, but from the point of being born again and following Christ, why is it such a bad thing to say it's possible to follow Christ?
Yeah, no, great question, Danny. And I think your question gets into the complex issue of both their material theological positions, right, on the one hand, and then there are readings of specific biblical passages. That it's are bound up with. And so one of the crucial issues here is Romans 7. Is it the believer or not? Right? So the Protestant position is, by and large, at this point, is very much pretty unanimously, that is Romans 7 describes Paul in a regenerate state. Whereas, and so if you're going to go that reading of Romans 7, then going the other route, it's going to be harder. Right. Whereas, even that is not that reading of Romans 7 downstream of Regensburg a ways. It's not unanimous. Right. So Arminius, for example. So all that to say, these issues. So there's the material theological positions and what is but then also there's really, really important, interesting work to be done, I think, on the history of exegesis. And yeah, actually, somebody doing really good work on this right now, young guy, Jeb Ralston, he is doing history of exegesis of Romans 5 at the time of Reformation, and he's looking at a lot of these issues. I don't think he's quite done with his dissertation yet, but keep an eye out for it, because that's going to be addressing a lot of these issues in a really thorough way. So keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I totally agree. I mean, Romans 7 is a key area of debate, as are some other texts. But maybe we could even dig into that another episode here and kind of just dive in a little bit. One other thing I was going to throw out, just jumping back to the image of God piece, is I kind of, again, I feel like I'm with Eck on a lot of this stuff, but this point about the image of God a little bit later in Article 4, where it said that there's a vestige of the image of God that remains after sin, but then it says it happens that God does not acknowledge it because it's very small. I'm like, what are we talking about here? What? First of all, what does very small mean? That's kind of vague language. And then it's acknowledged that it's there, but God doesn't acknowledge it. Why wouldn't, I mean, to me, this just seems kind of sloppy, honestly.
So, man, at the risk of losing my Protestant cred along with Danny. I didn't love this section either. Both because, so in the notes, Gaetano points out, Eck raises the potential kind of terminological issue that like vestiges has an established meaning. And it's not that there's vestiges of the image, right? There's vestiges of the Trinity, right? Which is also actually part of the response. Like, oh, here's why vestiges is okay to use. So there's that. Then this also kind of like, this might be in the notes too, but part of the issue is there's like distinctly Lutheran concerns and motivations that end up like cropping up downstream of this, because Matthias Flacius, we've talked about the Flacian controversy, right? This radical Lutheran guy who wants,
I know nothing of this controversy.
Yeah. So fascinating radical Lutheran. He was, you know, important Lutheran theologian, did a lot of biblical work actually, but kind of we're among friends. I mean, he goes nuts on original sin. He describes sin as a substance rather than an accident.
Well, we find people saying sin is a substance rather than an accident after that too, right? I mean, that we find issues cropping up in various places.
Yep. So it keeps cropping up and returning. And actually, so downstream also, the Formula of Concord, the Lutheran confessional document, it condemns that view. It condemns the flaking view. So the Protestants, or the Lutherans, I'm sorry, are say no to that particular construal.
But I guess I have just kind of like a traditional view of the nature of some of these Reformation debates, at least a traditional view, in the sense that although there were these disputes over original sin, I don't see why they have to be determinative. I mean, so like all this stuff that I'm agreeing with Eck on is totally separate or at least distinct from the doctrine of justification. I mean, I can take a very traditional Protestant line on the nature of justification, for example, and disagree radically with Eck and the other 16th century Catholic authors, and then also on papal authority and many other things. So I don't see kind of taking the view that the image of God remains after the fall and the various things we've been talking about as kind of implying a wholesale embrace of the Roman position in that at that time.
So I can imagine an article that one of the reasons that both sides are animated about this debate, the reason that they care, and the Protestants more so than the Catholics, is because of, to some extent, the implications for the doctrine of justification. So it'd be really, really interesting to do something of like postmortem. Okay, here's the Protestant line on original sin. And the reason this is the Protestant line is because of the implications for justification, and kind of examining the inferences there and seeing like, okay, is it actually the case that we need to say X about original sin? Or could one be a straight Anselmian and Protestant doctrine of justification is still motivated?
Yeah.
My inclination's with you, Danny.
I make some arguments in the eighth chapter of my book on original sin to this effect around justification. It gets kind of technical, as some reviewers have pointed out.
Complained.
But I thought it was interesting at the time, and kind of basically, yeah, I just made the case like, yeah, you can have multiple views of justification and they go together with, I was defending a kind of broadly Thomist view of original sin, but a lot of the same stuff applies, mutatis mutandis, to Anselm as well. So, but yeah, so I've started making the argument, but yeah, I agree. There's more arguments to be had.
Well, it sounds like there's more discussion to be had, but I know Joel has to close up shop here on us. So for those who are listening, obviously there's a lot more opportunity to engage this topic. And I encourage you to go check out all the essays in the symposium and then to continue to write and research in these areas, because as it seems to be clear, at least to me, there's a lot more opportunity to be had to discuss and explain what's going on here. So everybody's been tuning in. We appreciate you for listening and to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.